Hello. 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 Hello.
Welcome to the Karen Conti Show on 720 WGN.
Good evening, everyone. Karen Conti here. Happy June 23rd. Oh, and happy summer to everybody. You know, we've got a really action-packed show tonight. But before I introduce who our guests are going to be, I wanted to talk about a news story that I saw that people are kind of nervously speaking about. And that is the case of the Michigan man who won an $80 million Mega Million jackpot in the lottery. And he had to share it with his ex-wife. Now, during the course of his marriage, he filed for divorce. And in the process of the divorce is when he won that lottery ticket. And the judges said, you know what? You were still married at the time that you won it, and therefore it's what we call marital property. And the appellate court said that basically you were playing the lottery during the course of the marriage. You were losing money, you know, for the most part. So you share the losses with your wife, and you share the profits with your wife until the day that you're divorced. A lot of people think that once you file for a divorce, everything's over, and that you get to keep your stuff that you got afterwards. That's just not the case in Illinois, and it's not the case in most states, including Michigan, where this case came down. And interestingly, the judges went on to say that the $1 that he used to buy the ticket that won $80 million was marital money, meaning it belonged to her too. So 50 cents of that dollar went to buy that ticket, and therefore she gets to share in the profits. And interestingly, maybe even more interesting than the fact that he has to share it, is that after fees and taxes, $80 million comes down to a mere paltry $38 million, of which she will get half. And, you know, it's an interesting story. It's a story that people are kind of chuckling about. But it does kind of bring up a topic for people, and that is, and I've probably had 5 or 6 WGN listeners call me or email me about the fact that they're married, but they haven't seen their spouse in 10 years, and they've been living apart, and they don't know what's going on, and should I get a divorce, and I don't really want to spend the time and the money. But the problem during the time that you're still married, everything that you earn could be split with your spouse. So let's just say you have a job where you're earning retirement money in a 401k, or you're putting money away. Well, you think you're putting it away for you, but 50% of that is probably going to go to your spouse if you get divorced and if the judge decides it. So there's a reason to get divorced, because you want to make sure that, I mean, it's not that you want to do something terrible to your ex-spouse, but you want to make sure if it's money that you're earning that you're not sharing it with somebody who you're not sharing a house with. And the other situation that I see sometimes is one spouse perhaps gets sick. Maybe, unfortunately, comes down with cancer or some disease, or, you know, something that disables them. Well, a judge might require the spouse who is well to support the spouse who is not, because that spouse cannot support herself or himself, and you might be called upon to do that if you're still married. So there's some good reasons to end it. You know, I'm not saying everyone should get divorced right away, but what I'm saying is, once you know that it's not going to work out, once you know that the marriage is over, that is probably a good time to bite the bullet and get it done. Let's see. I'm a man, and I believe that's true. 50-50. You made a commitment, and you stick to it. Well, the judges definitely agree with you, and I don't know that I've ever seen a judge or an appellate court disagree. Until the day you're married, if you win that lottery, during the course of the marriage, you're going to split it with your spouse. Let's talk about some things that we're going to talk about. Ultimately, the 8 to 9 hour is the usual time that I take your legal questions. I'm a practicing lawyer, been doing it. Now I'm going on 34 years. I can say going on 34 years. That sounds like an eternity. But I'll take any legal question you have. And one of the things that I'd like to talk about, along with your legal problems or like legal issues, is this special prosecutor who was appointed in the Jussie Smollett case. Again, are you sick of the case? Maybe you are, but it's an interesting study in how our system works and how the checks and balances can work. And I'd like to discuss a little bit with you on how that might play out. And I'll take your calls and your questions about that. Why don't you put this in your phone? 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. 7200, and that'll be around the 8 o'clock hour. I'll be taking all your calls and texts. And then our next guest, is, you know, I watched the news, and there was an article about nannies, and article saying that some nannies are being paid between $150,000 and $200,000 a year to raise children. These people are experts in child care. They have degrees, advanced degrees in some cases. They speak multiple languages, and people with a lot of money are hiring them to raise their children. And, you know, I'd like to hear from you, too, about this. Have you ever hired a nanny? Have you hired an au pair? What qualities would you look for? Let's just say money was no issue and you had a child, or you have a grandchild that's being raised. Who would you want to be caring for your child and teaching them things? Or is daycare better because daycare socializes children? We'll be talking to the Windy City Nanny, who is an expert in the issue of nanny affairs. And we're going to be talking just briefly about that issue and what that means for mothers and for families raising children. And then about 7:30, we're going to talk about words. And now don't tune out. This is a good one. There are some very, very interesting histories behind different phrases. Like, for instance, do you know that phrase, she can't hold a candle to him, or she can't hold a candle to her? Well, back in the day when the artists were working in their studios, there would be someone at night who would hold a candle so that the artist could continue to work, because there was no electricity, of course. So the job of the assistant, they would say in a kind of a mean way, that person is not even fit to be an assistant, let alone an artist. So he can't hold a candle to you. So that was a backwards way of saying you're not even good enough to hold that candle for the artist. So things like that, we're going to talk about interesting derivations of words and maybe some words that we've all been using wrong. We've got a really interesting guest who's got his own radio show. He talks about words and word use, he's going to come on at about the 7:30 hour. Right now, we are going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking about nannies.
You want this choice position. Have a cheery disposition. Rosy cheeks, no warts.
That's the part I put in.
Play games, all sorts. You must be kind, you must be...
These are all the qualifications of a good nanny. I think Mary Poppins had all of them, really, if you think about it. You know, childcare positions, we usually don't think of them as the great paying jobs. In fact, you know, in some ways, I still think of those as jobs you get maybe when you're in college or you're in between college and grad school. But not so much. Wealthy families are now seeking nannies who are trained in all kinds of things, child development, languages, and all kinds of things. And they're earning up to $200,000 a year. Absolutely interesting. So joining us to talk about this issue, do you really need a nanny who's that qualified? And can you get something for less than $200,000? Florence Ann Romano, the Windy City Nanny, is the author of a book, Nanny and Me. Thank you for joining us on the Karen Conti Show. Hi, Florence.
Hello. Thanks for having me. And thanks for that intro song. I just smiled the whole time listening to it.
Well, we need Mary Poppins, not so much because we need her to care for our children. We just need the umbrella.
Who doesn't need that umbrella,
yeah, exactly.
Right? Especially in Chicago, we need that umbrella every day.
That's right. Okay, are nannies worth that much money, Florence? Is this something, are these people really that qualified that they could command that kind of salary?
Yeah, they can. It's the truth. They are that qualified to be able to use that, you know, salary as a negotiator. And, you know, when you look at some of these nannies and their bios, their resumes, they're trained, you know, in all these amazing, you know, universities, and they've taken all these classes, and they speak all these different languages, and they're educated to the hilt. When you have that, yes, you absolutely do have that in your arsenal to use as a negotiating, factor. Just like if you were going to in corporate America and you were like, hey, I've got my MBA from here and there, and I've got all these degrees, it's the same thing. So yes, they can command that salary, but they have to have the goods to back it up. And they're also going to be working for a family that can afford to pay that. And it's also looking for a certain type of pedigree in that nanny.
Now, you know, I know daycare is crazy expensive. In my line of work, I do family law, you know, work litigation, and I people fight about daycare. Should we have daycare? Should we have a babysitter? Should we have a nanny? And people fight about different daycares. Is it better to have a child in daycare? Is there more socialization there? Is a nanny the way to go? Is there a right way to have a helper for a busy mom? And dad,
and all the different families out there. Yeah, you know, I wish I could say there's a right way to do it. It's really what's going to be right for your family. But I will say, in daycare, there are the pros and cons. And yes, it's probably just as expensive as you having an in-home nanny or even participating in a nanny share program. Sometimes that's more economical for families, you know, doing that. And it also socializes the children. But daycare comes with its own issues. You know, the children are exposed to more germs. I mean, they're going to be building that immune system in 2 seconds flat because they're going to contract every little thing going to daycare. And I have plenty of friends who have pulled their children out of daycare because they're sick of them getting sick, truthfully. But having a nanny, that one-on-one that the children get, and even if it's not one-on-one, that nanny's taking care of that, you know, more than one child in that family, there is something to be said for having that isolated attention on your children, especially if you're going to be hiring a nanny to, in some ways, enhance their education. There are many nannies out there that come to the table with a background in child education or child psychology, or they're former nurses, and they have a background dealing with children. I'm seeing it more and more now where people are hiring, families are hiring these nannies to be an extension of their education and their curriculum. And I think that's fantastic if you're hiring a nanny to extend their education beyond the classroom or prepare them for preschool or teach them another language. So there are pros and cons to both, but it's really going to depend on what financially your family can afford to do. And also you have to know what your family needs, what you want for your children, and most importantly, what brings you peace of mind as the parent.
Florence, is there some idea that a nanny could draw attention away from mom and dad, and that sharing that kind of affection may be confusing for a child? Or are there any studies like that, or is that just not rational?
It's not that it's not rational. It's a great question. Yeah, I can't tell you how many times I've seen moms in front of me get all teary-eyed thinking, oh my gosh, my baby's going to like me more, you know, like you more than they like me. And, you know, that's so not the case. I have to say, in my many years of experience, I've come to realize something. You don't ever want to feel like you're competing with the parent or the parent is competing with the nanny. If you can look at it through the lens of, I'm like an aunt to this child or an uncle to this child, if the parent can look and say, that, you know, this person's like a godparent to my child. They're going to be a good role model. They're going to give them another slice of life, another flavor. They're another person to love my child. You should want to encourage your child to have relationships with other people that they love and will learn from and feel safe with. So if you can look at it that way, then you're never going to let that competitive streak kind of, you know, seep in. And if your child ever reaches for the nanny instead of you, I know that that's just going to crush you. I've seen it happen in front of me. But I had one employer tell me when she saw that happen, that, you know, the child reached for me instead of her. The mom looked at me and said, I have to tell you, I'm just happy that she loves you. That makes me happy. And I know it hurt her to see that happen. But I promise you, the minute I left, that baby was so happy to be with her mom. So I would try to suggest and encourage to those mommies and daddies out there to please not let that get in the way of, you know, the nanny and the child forming a relationship, because that's really a beautiful bond.
Florence, I want to just ask you one last quick question because this went way too fast. But in your little bullet points to me, you talked about two things that were very important, a strong vocabulary, and you talked about unstructured play. Can you just devote like 1 minute to that, to those two topics?
An unstructured play, I think, is very interesting. The Montessori school started that a long time ago, where they didn't care what the kid did when they came to school as long as they got to do what they wanted to do and it was productive. Unstructured play is a time for children to use their imagination. I don't think children do it enough today because they're so plugged in on technology and other things that are distracting. But imagination is the reason we have these incredible entrepreneurs and business people and, you know, folks in the medical world solving all sorts of diseases. We have to encourage our children to grow in that way. And language is so important from a young age. By the time they're 3 years old, they're already starting to have a hard time processing and absorbing another language, which if you can believe that's true. So you do want to encourage your children to learn another language and learn their own language. And it's great if they have older siblings. You'll be so surprised to see how fast the second born catches up with the first because they're exposed to that education, that vocabulary so early on. So if you think of it that way, that second child is already catching up in that way, you need to do that from the get-go and expose them as much as you can from birth.
Florence Romano, thank you so much for joining us. The Windy City Nanny, where can we reach you and where can we get your book, which is called Nanny and Me?
You can go to WindyCityNanny.com. I'm all over social media as well. And you can purchase the book anywhere online, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, but you can also do it right from my website.
Thank you for joining me. Take care. We're going to take
Thanks
a break.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. We'll take a break. We'll come back with the Karen Conti Show.
And that's why I think it's a good time to learn some grammar. What? Now did I stammer? Work on that grammar. You should know way. It's fluffer, it's fewer. Oh, yeah. Like people who were right. Never raised in a sewer. I hate these word crimes. Like I could
grammar, you know. I speak and I write for a living on the courtroom, on the radio, to clients, all over. And I think we all do. We all make our livings. We all have relationships. And it all depends on our ability to communicate and to do it in the way that makes sense, the way that's clear, I think is a really important thing. And we all make mistakes. I make them all the time. And in fact, you listeners, you always call in and text in and tell me when I'm pronouncing something wrong. But with us tonight is someone who studies words and how we speak and how we talk about things and how some people say things that may seem right, but may not be the best of choices. Grant Barrett is a lexicographer. I'm saying that wrong, probably. He's going to correct me. Linguist and public speaker. He co-hosts a nationwide public radio show called Away with Words. You might have heard it. He's the author of The Perfect English Grammar and the compiler of the Official Dictionary and Unofficial English and the Oxford Dictionary of American Political Slang. Welcome to the show, Grant. How are you?
Hello, Karen. Everything's great. How are you?
Good. All right. I thought that we'd start with just trying to get through as many of these. You gave me some really common mistakes that people make. I don't want to say mistakes, but it's just things that people say that may not be the very best way to say it.
Right.
You know, we're not trying to chastise people because I'm learning more here than probably anyone. So let's start with ETC.
Oh, yeah. So we want to use ETC in order to save more of the same, right? You say apples, bananas, et cetera, right? But the problem is it's a Latin word borrowed into English, and we kind of get it wrong. There's like four major pronunciations, and only one of them really is the best pronunciation, and that is et cetera. It's E-T, not E-X at the beginning. But the problem is the T and the C in our mouth want to do something different. It's very easy for the form and shape of the mouth to slip and turn into an X sound instead of a TS sound. So, again, it's a real common mistake. Another thing that people do, just to be on the lookout for, is sometimes they make it one syllable too short. They say et cetera, but it actually needs that other syllable in there. It's et cetera, usually spelled as one word these days in dictionaries.
So now we know. And you know what? I have to say, I couldn't care less.
Could you care less or couldn't care less?
Well, which one is right? Could I care less or couldn't I care less? What am I trying to say?
All right. So people have been complaining about other people saying, I could care less since at least the 1960s. So this is a longstanding disagreement. The original form was, I couldn't care less, meaning I care absolutely not at all for whatever you're talking about. And there's no more care left in me, right? But the early forms of this were variable. One of them was as if I could care less. As if I could care less. And in that form, the negative isn't really clear there. As if I could care less. There's no not apparent there. It is a negative. It's a negative statement. And so that shortened easily becomes I could care less. Still negative, even still without the not in it. And so it's kind of logical once you have it explained. It's very easy to look at other people and say, well, they must just be dumb or uneducated. But so often when you hear a lot of people saying a thing that's not quite right, there's usually a really matter-of-fact, ordinary reason that they're doing it. It's usually not because they're lazy or stupid.
So what would be the best thing to say? If I really didn't give one flying you-know-what about what you're saying, I would say, Grant,
I couldn't Couldn't care less. Couldn't care less. I want to tell you another thing about this, though. The thing with a lot of people who say, I could care less, they've rationalized it. And very cleverly, though, what they say is, when I say I could care less, what I mean is, I care a tiny little bit. And, you know, if you keep pushing me, I might stop caring that much at all and care nothing. So what they think that they're saying is, I could care less, meaning don't press me. Don't rush me on this. Don't push too hard.
Now, this is one of my favorites. This is one of my favorites. Supposedly versus supposedly. Right?
All right. Now, we're on the radio, so you and I are going to have to pronounce this very clearly so people can say the difference. So supposedly with a B-L-Y at the end, B as in boy, and supposedly with a D-L-Y as in dad or David, right, at the end. And the thing is, 100% of the time, people mean to say supposedly with a D in there. But sometimes, try both words in your mouth. Just do this. Supposedly, supposedly. Supposedly, supposedly. And what happens is, feel where the mouth and the tongue and the teeth, feel what they're all doing. They're very close. It is incredibly easy to slip or to just say the other thing instead of the correct, better choice. So supposedly with a D is what you want. If you find yourself saying supposedly, you're probably wrong and you need to move on. Just think a second about it and the D form will come naturally to you.
All right, let's hone in on the next one. Or is it home in?
Well, Karen, that is actually a question I want to ask you. If you were preparing a legal brief, you want to say, I want to hone in on this issue so that we can get to the bottom of the matter, are you saying hone in with an N, H-O-N-E? Or are you saying home in with an M?
I would say N, with an N as in
you
Nancy.
Would.
I would, but am I wrong?
Okay.
Oh,
well,
no.
Let me ask you, do you mean that you are sharpening or improving the thinking as you're getting to the idea?
No, I'm thinking of focus. I'm thinking I'd like to hone in and focus.
Yeah, so the better choice in this case is home, H-O-M-E. I want to give you a trick to get this right. Two things. Think of homing pigeons, which go home when you release them, and think of homing beacons, which are a thing that, say, a ship that's lost at sea might have a beacon so that the rescuers can find it, right? Both of these are about zeroing in on a target.
Okay.
Now, there is a strong case that a lot of people make about hone in, H-O-N-E. What do we do when we sharpen a knife? We hone it, right? And that makes a lot of sense. They're like, well, I'm sharpening my thinking. I'm getting towards the idea by eliminating all the stuff I don't want and really just leaving only the fine point of it. It makes a lot of sense. It's a very good rationalization, which is why right now, if you look at the data, about 50-50 in younger speakers, people under 30. So we're at a point where both of these expressions are widely used.
Let's talk about intensive purposes. For all intensive purposes, this conversation is blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, this conversation is super nerdy, Karen.
Well, hey, we're both word nerds, so.
Right. Two different kinds of word nerd. Okay, so you've seen people write, maybe on a Facebook post or Reddit or something, they write, well, for all intents and purposes, I believe that X should be Y. And they write intensive, I-N-T-E-N-S-I-V-E. But what they should be writing is all intents and purposes. They're taking intents, I-N-T-E-N-T-S, and it's the word and, A-N-D, and they're making it into intensive. And they're rationalizing this in the process to creating what is known as an eggcorn, E-G-G-C-O-R-N, C-O-R-N. An eggcorn is a linguistic term that was coined when somebody doesn't quite understand the phrase or the idiom or the expression, and they come up with a version that's really close to it that kind of makes some sense. And the word itself, eggcorn, is an eggcorn because acorn, like the nut that falls from an oak tree, some people mishear that. They mishear A-C-O-R-N as E-G-G-C-O-R-N. They think it's eggcorn. So in all intents and purposes, is an eggcorn. It makes a little bit of sense because you're talking about being very intense towards purpose. And the thing that throws us is that intense is a plural noun is really rare outside of this expression in English. It's not comma. We're more likely to say intentions. And so your brain is doing this automatic problematic math saying, that can't be right. Nobody says intense. I think they mean intensive, and you're just putting it in there.
So all intents and purposes. And then one final one before we go to break. And this one, I understand the difference, but I don't use it correctly on a regular basis. And that is farther and further. Can you quickly tell our listeners what's the? How do you use those two differently?
Farther is about distance, and further is about everything else. We went farther than the map showed. That's with an A, farther. She took the matter further, all the way to the board of directors. That's with a U.
Got it. Well, that's easy. Farther is for is for distance, and further is for everything else. And before we talk any farther, or further, before we talk any further, we're going to have to take a break. We're talking to Grant Barrett. He's a linguist and public speaker, and we're talking about grammar. And when we come back, we're going to be talking about derivations and some very interesting phrases. This is the Karen Conti Show on WGN.
More than words is all you have to do to make it real. Then you wouldn't have to.
We're talking about words here with Grant Barrett, who's a lexicographer, linguist, and public speaker. He co-hosts a nationwide public radio show called Away with Words. And we're talking about word derivations. We're talking about misuse of words. And one of our texters, Grant, said people who want to say or write voila when they mean voila. Can you weigh in on that one?
Yeah, so the French is V-O-I-L-A, and there's an accent on the A. It's a grave accent, which means it goes from the upper left to the lower right. But because the word is slowly becoming anglicized, people hear it third, fourth, fifth, infinite hand. They don't hear it directly from a French speaker. And so they're doing their best guess. And they write it as W-A-L-L-A-H and a variety of, I think somewhere I have a list of like 13 different spellings I've found. So this is a natural process of anglicization of a foreign word.
Interesting.
I kind of, as a French speaker myself, I would prefer that they keep the French spelling, but I get it. That accent's weird and it's clearly foreign, so you try to make it English.
Well, for all intents and purposes, they get it right.
Yeah, right.
Okay, so now let's switch over to phrases that we use every day. And, you know, I guess we just use these phrases and we don't think about where the what the history is. These are some ones. Let's start with to butter someone up. Where did that come from?
This dates to the 1700s, and the idea is that butter is a greasy substance, and if you butter someone, you make things smoother between you. You are literally lubricating the situation.
And that makes a lot of sense. And now, some of these make a lot of sense, and some of these, it's a strain. I almost say like, wow, that comes a long way. How about break the ice?
Okay, so this goes back to a time when you might have spent a lot more time boating places or traveling across water courses. And what you might do is you would break the ice if you were the first one there after a freeze so that the people behind you would have an easier passage. And so you're making it easier for the people around you. So the metaphor that we use at, say, a social gathering comes directly from this kind of prosaic day-to-day use that we no longer really have or think of.
And another one that is widely used, and I think I was wrong about this one, which is mad as a hatter. I'm mad as a hatter. Now, what do you think? What, you would think that would be Alice in Wonderland, right?
But no, it's older than that. They get the mad hatter from this metaphor. I think Lewis Carroll really came up with the idea from knowing that hatters, milliners, often worked with mercury, and mercury is a poisonous substance, and it affects the nervous system. It causes all kinds of ailments and physical tics, and you look like you're off kilter, off balance. And so hatters were known to have what was called the hatter's shakes from this. And so being mad doesn't mean angry. It means being crazy or insane or just being non-normal. So it's 1800s or so.
Interesting.
Yeah.
How about barking up the wrong tree?
So when was the last time you went hunting with dogs, Karen?
I haven't done it yet, but...
Okay. Well, if you go hunting with dogs, they're pretty smart animals, but sometimes whatever they're chasing slips by them and goes up a different tree, and so they're literally barking at the base of the wrong tree, and the animal is up a different tree, possibly hopping from tree to tree, getting away.
Oh, there we go. And while we're talking about animals, and I'm not sure this is on our list, but how about raining cats and dogs? Do you know where that one comes from?
there is a common false story floating around that I'm going to take a minute to less than a minute to debunk. It is not from thatched roofs with dogs and cats falling down through thatched roofs. It's simply talking about large drops of rain that resemble living creatures themselves because they're so violent and wild. That's it. It's really just a comparison to the size of big rain. It says nothing whatsoever to animals falling through roofs.
Now let's go to another animal reference, which is cat got your tongue.
Yeah, another one to debunk. It has nothing to do with sailors and the cat of nine tails. It's simply about the playful natures of cats who will go after any wiggling thing, including your tongue. Dates to about the 1850s.
So when you say cat got your tongue, but you're not talking, so you're saying what's wrong with you? Oh, so like the cat got and scratched or ate your tongue, so therefore you can't talk.
Well, the same way that a cat will go after a dragged feather or a bit of loose string, if you're gabbing a lot and your tongue is wagging, why wouldn't the cat maybe go after that too?
Interesting. How about let the cat out of the bag, now that we're talking about cats?
Did you ever hear the expression, a pig in a poke?
Sure. Yeah.
Do you know what it means?
Not really. I mean, I don't.
Like a scam, right?
A scam, right.
Or a ripoff, right? Yeah. So both of these expressions are related. There was an old scam dating back to the 1700s that say that you were going to a country fair, and in order to sell you piglets, which you would then feed and grow up into a full hog and then butcher for meat, they would sell them in bags just because it's easier to carry a piglet around in a bag, right, than in any other kind of device. But sometimes the scammers would put a cat in there instead. And so your job was to open the bag to make sure there's a piglet in there before you paid for it. And that was literally letting the cat out of the bag. You were revealing whether or not there was a scam involved. And a pig in a poke is another name for a bag or a sack.
Interesting. All right. Giving you the cold shoulder. I'm giving you the cold shoulder.
Yeah, this is just about the warmth and coldness. So we think of warmth as a positive emotional response to somebody, right? And coldness is a negative emotional response. It's the opposite of a shoulder to cry on. It's the shoulder that is withdrawn from you and offers you no love or comfort.
Oh, get one's goat.
It's not related to a cold shoulder of lamb, which is what some people think.
Oh, okay. I didn't think that.
Yeah.
get one's goat. Where did that come from?
All right. So horse racing, is this something that you've been to? Don't go down to the track once in a while?
I was just at Churchill Downs, yes.
Wonderful. So you were there for the Derby, and I don't know if they still do this, but what they used to do is they would put goats in with these very nervous and high-strung horses because it calms them down. The presence of another living creature, be it human or animal, can make a horse more pliable when it comes time to run the race. And so in order to get some advantage over your competitors back in the day, you might slip into the stables and take the goat away from the racehorse so that the horse was nervous come race time. And that was literally getting that horse's goat.
Interesting, like a service coat.
Yeah, with the little vest and the whole thing, yes.
I can see it now. And this one wasn't on our list, but as long as we're talking about horses, let's get it straight from the horse's mouth.
Oh, so straight from the horse's mouth. This goes back to a joke that people would tell about when you tried to sell a horse for more than it was worth or claim that it was younger than it really is. The way that you tell is you look at its teeth, because the older a horse is, the more the gums have receded and the longer the teeth look. So when you get the truth about something, you don't listen to the owner of the horse or the person selling it. You look in the horse's mouth to get the real information about the quality of that animal.
And you just said another one here, which was long in the tooth, which probably goes back to
same thing, the length
of the teeth, meaning that they're getting a little old.
Exactly right.
Wow.
Exactly right.
We went through all of these. Grant Barrett, thank you so much for joining us. Can you tell?
Oh, Karen, it was a pleasure.
That was fun. Can you tell our listeners where they can reach you and where they can listen to your radio show?
Yeah, just look for our website, waywardradio.org. We're on coast to coast. We're kind of hit parts of Chicago through Wisconsin Public Radio, but just go to waywardradio.org.
Grant Barrett, thank you so much for joining us. Have a good night.
Take care.
When we come back, we are going to be taking your legal questions at from 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock, 312-981-7200. It's time to call in with your legal questions. If you have any, 981-7200, 312-981-7200. 7200 or text to that number on any legal question you might have. I'll try to give you an answer or steer you in the right direction. And I can also talk about any news stories that you find interesting. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Jussie Smollett special prosecutor ruling this week. Friday, the ruling came down. I'm going to talk a little bit about what I think might be happening in this case and what we're going to be looking toward. But again, 981-7200. If for some reason you don't want to talk on air, I'm always available to talk privately. The best way to reach me is 312-332-7800. And even better, email me. And the email address is wgn@askkarenconti.com, KarenConti. And basically, you're going to give me where you live, what county you live in, and what happened to you, what you expect, what your concerns are. And if I didn't say when it happened, probably that would be a good thing, because there are statutes of limitations and there are rules about when you can bring lawsuits and when you can assert your legal rights. Try to get back to everybody by either giving them a call back or an email back, or try to refer them to a lawyer who might be appropriate for their case, or give them a link to something that might explain the answer. But let's go to the phones, 981-7200. Let's go to Randall. Hi, Randall. Welcome to the Karen Conti Show.
Hi, Karen. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Good. Listen, I have a question about an ingress breast easement. I have one of those that crossed over my land. And I was wondering if I could put a fence up across that opening of the ingress easement.
Okay, now you said it was an easement. What kind of easement is it? Is it a utility easement?
Oh, no, it's an ingress-egress easement.
Okay, so your neighbor...
It's for ingress and egress, and, you know, only.
For who? So for a neighbor? Is it for a neighbor to get in and out?
Yeah, he has the right to cross over my land.
Okay,
and
so...
I'm sorry,
you want to put a fence to block him from doing that?
I want to put a fence with access, like a gate in the fence, so I can, you know, like, so his stuff, I don't have to see all of his stuff. In other words, I'm not going to stop him from coming and going, I just want to put a fence. I had a lawyer, one guy tell me... can you put up a fence? He says probably yes. But he never gave me a definitive yes or no.
Okay. You know what, Randall, can I put you, can I drop you and then can you listen on the radio so I can give you an answer without the noise in the background?
Sure.
Okay. Thanks for the call. You know, easements, just so people know, you know, it's a right for someone else to come on your property and use it without possessing the property. So, yes, you have a right to your entire property, but there is an easement, which means a lot of times it's a utility. Utilities can come onto your property to check the wires, okay? Or let's just say, it's kind of hard to picture, but maybe your neighbor needs to come onto your property to access his property. And he's got an easement. That means he can't do anything with the property. He can't own it. He can't build on it. But he has a right to use that land that belongs to you in order to get to his property. So, and there are other kinds as well. And there's other whistles and bells that come with that. Without me looking at a deed, you know, and probably bringing in a real estate lawyer to look at it, it's very unclear, Randall, whether or not I can say, go ahead and build that fence. But suffice to say that if the easement is for him to access his property, you've got to leave that open for him to access the property. Putting a gate there probably is not the right thing to do. Again, if you need a lawyer who's very well schooled in that, I've got a couple of people who I could recommend you. So, Randall, if you want to send me an email, WGN@AskKarenConti.com. I can give you that referral. They probably will take a retainer, a small retainer, and give you some legal advice after having looked at the deed and the easement. But I think, you know, you're certainly, you sometimes can build on an easement as long as you're not going to block the people from coming in and out or from accessing the right of way. Okay. So again, specifically, I can't answer your question, but just know that if you in any way impede the person who has the easement, you could be sued and it could be a problem. Okay. I hope that answers it as best we can. John. Hi, John. Welcome to WGN. How are you? Hi, John. Hello, John.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Hello.
You have a legal question. Hi.
Yes. Sorry. So question, if you have an injury at a commercial facility that results in you having to make a claim on your personal insurance, and then you return to the facility for subrogation, is it also customary that they also offer funding for pain and suffering?
Okay, so you were at a business and you fell, right?
Right.
And was it as a result of some unsafe condition at the property, or was it just a pure accident that you tripped and fell?
So the curve to the establishment is higher than normal, which contributed to it. So imagine a cut curve, and this near the entrance, for some reason, the curve is higher than a normal street curve to the entrance to the door.
So it
contributed to the fall.
Okay. So you're, and then your private health insurance covered your injuries, et cetera, correct?
Right.
Okay, so what would happen? Let's just say you got a lawyer, and the lawyer determined that there was a personal injury suit, which would mean that this place of business was negligent in maintaining its property in some way, and that you were entitled to some compensation. If your lawyer brought that lawsuit, she would ask for all the damages relating to that injury, meaning your medical bills, your pain and suffering, any permanency, any lost wages, and all of those things would be on the table. And hopefully you would get recovery in that regard. Now, when you get that recovery, whether you settle or go to trial, what happens is your private carrier, whether it's, Humana, let's say, Humana pays all the bills, Humana would have a right to get some of that money back that they paid. That's part of the reason that's one of the things that you sign when you sign away your on health insurance, that your health insurance carrier will be compensated if you go out and get some recompense for the personal injury. So they would be entitled to a portion of it, not all of it. Probably your lawyer would negotiate down that lien, the insurance lien, but you should be entitled to, pain and suffering, lost wages, and some of the other things that perhaps your health insurance is not going to pay for. Does that answer your question?
Is there a difference between is there a difference between how it has to be classified? In other words, does it have to be personal injury, and or can it be premise liability?
Those phrases don't mean anything. It's really just if you bring that lawsuit and there's a certain amount of money that the insurance company paid you, they have a lien, meaning they have a right to assert a portion of your settlement. And it would be up to your personal injury lawyer to talk them down on that, so to negotiate that lien down so you could keep more of the money than not. So if you want to discuss this further, and I don't do personal injury work. I have in the past, but I don't do this kind of work. But I do have people who are very good lawyers who work in this area. They do slip and falls. If you're in Palatine, that's probably Cook County. And I have some people who might be able to help you out. So I'm going to put you on hold, and I'm going to give out my contact information. 312-332-7800, or better yet, hopefully, John, you can send me an email, and I can send you that lawyer's contact information right back. And that is wgn@askkarenconti.com. Give me a call here. I'm hopefully going to be answering all of your legal questions tonight. The number here is 312-981-7200. Do you have family law questions? Do you have questions about contracts? Do you have questions about wills and estates? Personal injury, workers' compensation, any legal thing, anything you've seen in the news that is of interest to you, criminal law, ask me. I may not know the answer completely, but I can probably talk around it or maybe refer you in the right direction. 981-7200 or text to that same number. I'm going to give out my number at the office in case you'd like to speak personally. I do try to get back to everybody. May not be immediately if I'm in court. So, and hopefully I get back to you with the right information that can help you in the right direction. 312-332-7800. Or the best way to reach me is an email, wgn@askkarenconti.com. Let's go to Gary in Arlington Heights. Hi, Gary. How are you doing?
Yeah, pretty good. Nice talking to you.
Nice talking to you.
Yeah, this is sort of an unusual case. I went through a drive-through through a major chain. I don't know if I'm allowed to, you know, mention the chain, but big chain. And I bought a hamburger, and inside the hamburger was a dime. When I took a bite, the dime popped out.
Oh.
And it which sort of made me sick, and I drove around and returned the hamburger. But I called the corporation, or I made a complaint, and I got like three apologies about 3 weeks ago, and after that nothing happened. But I do have a witness that I dropped off at McDonald's that worked at McDonald's and knew that happened because he worked in that area, you know, where they cook it. And should there be more, or is there, you know, because I didn't swallow it. If I swallowed it, I might have been better off. And I didn't take a picture of it because I just wanted to return the hamburger, so I drove around the drive-through once again.
Well, you know, this is a very interesting issue, because this past week, I don't know if you saw it, it was on the internet. Someone was at a, and I'm not going to say the name of the chain, but was sitting at a chain restaurant, and out of the rafters dropped a dead rat right on his food. And it was, okay, there was a picture of it that he posted, and of course it went viral, and it was disgusting. And I was just actually talking to someone about it, because they asked me, is there a lawsuit? And this is kind of the same thing, in that, should there be a dime in your hamburger? Should there be a rat on your plate?
Yeah,
the answer is no, there should not be. But here's the thing, and I want to explain this, Gary, just because I'm explaining it not just to you, but to the larger crowd, because people think these are cases that make people a lot of money. But the idea is this. Were they negligent? Yes, because these things should not be in. Someone did something wrong. So there's no question that there was negligence on behalf of the restaurant. But there has to be damages that are attributable to that negligence, and you were disgusted. Okay, it made you kind of sick.
Yeah, I was throwing up for a little while. You know, I pulled off the side because it made me sick.
Yes,
but I did return it, and I got a receipt for, you know, which I still have.
So the idea is that, would a lawyer bring a lawsuit to compensate you for throwing up for a few minutes? And I don't mean to make light of that, because nobody wants this to happen. I had a client who ate at a very famous, I'm going to put this on hold here, a very famous chain, and there was blood all over the food, and she didn't realize it until she had eaten it. Well, the problem was, you know, we didn't know if it was infected with hepatitis. We didn't know, you know, anything about the person who was bleeding all over this food. And this is a disgusting conversation we're having. Hopefully nobody's eating a late dinner. But the problem is that unless there are serious damages, you know, some damage that you're really, you know, you had to have an operation, or you had to, you know, go to a doctor's office and have it removed, no lawyer's going to take a case for what might be $500 in damages. So what's your pain and suffering? What would a jury give you for throwing up for a few minutes? And I know that sounds cold and harsh, and you think, wow, I should be able to bring this lawsuit. But lawyers just don't spend all their time. I mean, to file the lawsuit in and of itself in Cook County, the filing fee that you pay to the clerk's office is over $400. And then you serve with the sheriff, which might be another $100-something. And so out of pocket, you're already $400 or $500 or $600. So, you know, then the lawyer may charge $200 an hour, $400 an hour. No lawyer's going to bring a case and litigate for 2 years over that. So was the chain wrong? Yes. And I always tell people, I would send a letter. I would not call. I would send a letter to corporate, see if you can find the legal department at that chain. And I would, if you took a picture, I forgot if you said you took a picture, I don't think you did take a picture, but you had someone who witnessed it and describe what happened, describe that you were sick and you were throwing up and that it was very upsetting to you. And maybe they'll send you something. Maybe they'll send you a gift certificate. Maybe they'll just send you an apology, but at least you can feel like you've made a difference, and maybe this won't happen to somebody else. And I think that's what a lot of people feel like, wow, if a dime went into my hamburger, what else could go in there? What else, you know, how is the sanitation, the sanitary, you know, rules being followed? And so I understand that, that you have that concern, but this is not a case that most lawyers would probably take, just so you know. That's the simple answer to your question. We have a texter named Dee. If you have time tonight, I joined a company middle of December of 2018. At the end of May, they announced that they had lost a management contract and my job was eliminated at the end of June. 75 people were losing their jobs. They had this information when I took the job. Now I have a six-month stint on my resume and I'm looking to be put into a financial crisis. Can you recommend someone? Dee, I'm really sorry to say this, but, you know, was that morally wrong for them to do it? Yes. If they knew they were going to have to fire you, why would they hire you? It sounds like they hired you away from a good job, from what you're telling me, and it was very inconvenient. Now you have to look for a job. Now you have this bad mark on your resume, which doesn't look good and might impede your ability to find work. This is a serious problem, but unfortunately, in Illinois, we're employees at will, unless you have a labor contract, and the fact that, you know, they didn't single you out. 75 other people are losing their jobs because of this management contract loss. Unless it's because of race or gender or sexual orientation or religion, national origin, military service, any of those protected classes, unless it's for that reason, they can fire you and they don't have to give you severance and they don't have to do anything for you, unfortunately. So, you know, the thing that I always say is go in there, you know, don't get a lawyer, because once a lawyer gets involved, you're going to pay a lawyer by the hour, and it's probably better for you just to go try to work it out. I mean, go to your boss's office and say, listen, this is putting me in a bind. You knew this at the time. Can you please give me some severance, and can you please put in my resume, my personnel file, you know, that I was a good worker, and so that when I go to get a job, it makes it easier for me to get a job. So you can walk away with a little bit of money, hopefully. He might have to sign a release for that, meaning you're not going to sue them. And, you know, then you know that you're going to get a good recommendation, which is ultimately what you want. You want to become reemployed as quickly as you can. And hopefully that'll help. But again, a lot of people don't get it. They think that there's a lawsuit when somebody did something wrong in the employment realm. Really, you're at the whim of your employer. And as I said, unless it's for some specific protected class reason, you don't have a lawsuit. Sorry to bring that bad news. Let's take your calls. We're going to continue to take your calls into the next half an hour. 981-7200, 981-7200, or text. You're listening to Karen Conti Show on WGN. Welcome back to the Karen Conti Show. I'm taking your legal questions, 981-7200, or text to that same number. The phone lines are wide open. You can give us a call. You'll be talking to Ben, my producer, and you're going to be giving a quick little brief. That's really redundant and yes, very redundant. Just a brief summary of what the issues are, and then we can put you right on the line, and we can see if we can straighten out your question. I have a texter who says, I'm not quite sure about this question. I have a home warranty, and our contract says they are not liable for damages, even if they breach the contract. If they intentionally and material breach the contract, doesn't that negate the contract and the protections provided to them? I asked, is this a new home warranty? No, existing. It came gratis when we bought the house, and we renewed it last year. I'm assuming these are home warranty about various things that could go wrong in the house, as far as appliances, foundation problems, roofing issues, and things like that. And those home warranties, now, if you got it free, that's not a bad thing. It looks like you re-upped it. But you really have to read those things to make sure that what you're getting is a good deal. I'm not saying you shouldn't have them, but, you know, if you're insuring certain things and you see that there's a limit to what they're going to pay, it may be that you just save up your money and save it for the furnace or for the washer dryer that you might need to replace eventually. A lot of these home warranties don't even cover major things. I had a case where the home warranty didn't even cover something basic, like the foundation was faulty. So you're asking me the question, What if they breach the contract? Are you saying that the insurance is the warranty? It's a insurance company, essentially. Are they breaching the contract? Are they saying they're not going to cover something that's covered? And that breach, obviously, is a breach of the home warranty. And technically, you could bring a lawsuit to cover it. But generally speaking, it's not worth it to bring a lawsuit to cover something that is in these warranties. You should just make sure you get a good company. You should put everything in writing. You should put pictures and repair costs and all receipts all in the email or the letter that you send to them and make your demand. I'm not sure if you gave me some more facts, maybe I could give you a little bit more specific answer, but clearly they can't violate the terms of their warranty if that's the if your question. And if they do, there is a lawsuit. The question is, can you bring a lawsuit against them? Is it worth it to hire a lawyer to do that? That's a lot of the answers that that I have tonight is, you know, yes, you have a lawsuit, but is it worth it to hire a lawyer? Let's go to Joyce. I think Joyce is in Indiana. Hi, Joyce. How are you?
I'm okay. I'm calling to find out what rights do a grandparent have. I haven't seen my granddaughter in 4 years since my son passed away. My daughter-in-law, for some reason, she's keeping her away from me. And I want to know, do I have any legal rights to do something about it?
Joyce, are you in Indiana?
Yes.
Okay, and you know what? I cannot answer the question from an Indiana lawyer's standpoint. I don't practice law there. I'm not licensed to practice. But let me put you on hold, and then I want you to email me tomorrow, and let me give you a referral to a lawyer in your area. What county are you in, Joyce?
Lake County. I'm in Hammond, Indiana.
Okay. I think I have someone there for you. Let me put you on hold, and let me answer that question when it comes to Illinois law, because a lot of grandparents have this question, and I'm going to answer it as if she were in Illinois. And Joyce, again, this may not apply to you because you're in a different state. Generally speaking, grandparents' rights are very limited because the law presumes that a parent has a right to basically control who sees their child. And if they don't want their parents to see the child, that's their choice and that's their constitutional right, in essence. However, in this case, Joyce, I saw that you your son died, and I'm sorry that happened. But in that case in Illinois, you would have a right to you would have grandparents' rights, because the law says that if your connection with that child is no longer there because he's either in jail, he's died, or you know, there's a divorce or something like that, where there's no that person's out of the picture, then someone who's, you know, who should be letting you see this child is not. And the law in Illinois would be that if that is unreasonable, if that child had a bond with you, that you're a good person, you're not doing drugs, that there's no good reason, the courts will order the daughter-in-law to bring the child for visitation. Now, it's not going to be 3 times a week and every other weekend. It's not going to be substitute for what your son would have gotten. But it might be a couple times a month. It might be for a holiday or something like that. And hopefully that's what the law is in Indiana. I really, it's an expensive process, and I know a lot of people have their reasons for not allowing a grandparent to see a child. But I say to everyone out there, it's probably best that this little child gets to know the side of the family where the father is deceased, unless there's a really good reason. Joyce sounds like a nice person. I mean, sounds like she really would love to see this child and shower this child with love and affection and have the child get to know that side of the family. I hope she gets to do that, and I'm going to give her the name of a lawyer who might be able to help her out and get that thing straightened out. You know, people do bad things to each other, and again, grandparents' rights are there, but it's under a very select group of circumstances, and Indiana may have a completely different law. Let's go to Don in Batavia. Donna Batavia, or do I need to take a break? Ben is waving. Okay. Hi, Don.
Hello again.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thank you for taking my call. Sure. I appreciate it, and I love your show. Been listening to you for years.
Thank you.
Oh, yes.
You have a question about gun rights. I'm not sure I'm going to be able to answer it, but why don't you give it to me?
So it's a case that was decided almost a year ago by the Ninth Circuit, but only a 3 judge panel for open carry in Hawaii, because open in Hawaii, even though they say they have concealed carry, they don't let anybody do it because it's Hawaii and it's corrupt. So a guy sued and said, okay, if you're not going to do this, then you got to let me do open carry. And he won. And the Ninth District, a three-judge panel affirmed it, but the state of Hawaii appealed to the full en banc, which is a unique term for ninth. And then they said, yeah, we'll take it. And then they said, you know what, we're going to wait till after the Supreme Court decides all their cases in June, because they have a State of New York Rifle and Pistol Association suing New York State. So we're going to wait till after that. I'm wondering.
Okay.
That seems corrupt to me, but okay. Do you know anything about this case? It's only for the Ninth District.
Okay, I just know enough that I know only, I'm going to put you on hold. What I really know is what you've told me. I've heard about this case, and let me just explain what's going on. So generally, the appellate court, the Seventh Circuit is where the Chicago judges sit, Ninth Circuit, California. So you have three judges who hear a case. Now, once in a while, you're as a litigant, you can ask for a rehearing. And if the whole panel and the whole circuit judge, the panel of judges, decides that this is a case that really we might want to reverse this, we might not want to agree with that panel, they hear it en banc, which means it's ENBANC, which means the entire court will hear it. So the entire court, however many judges there are, will sit and hear the case and rehear the issue again. And in that event, you know, it could be that this is reversed, because when they took it, they probably didn't like the opinion, or maybe they think they're going to change it. But interestingly, you're telling me that they're going to delay the hearing on this until the Supreme Court rules. And that would make sense, because the Supreme Court obviously is the law of the land. They're the highest court. And what the Supreme Court rules, it has to be followed pretty much by all the other courts. So why rule if the Supreme Court is going to do something that perhaps is contrary to what they might do? So it sounds to me like they're going to stay it, and they're going to let the Supreme Court rule, and then they're going to decide on that case. I don't know how they're going to come down. I barely know the facts of it, but that's the best I can tell you on it. Let's go to a break. I'll get to you, Ann. You got a timeshare issue. I'm going to give out the numbers, 981-7200, 981-7200. This is the Karen Conti Show, and you're listening to WGN. Welcome back. We're in the last leg here, and we're taking your legal questions. 981-7200, 981-7200. I'm trying to read some text here, and I'm going to get to your calls. Let's go to Anne in LaGrange. Hi, Anne. How are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. I'm actually calling on behalf of my sister, who is trying to get out of her timeshare program. And I was on a conference call this afternoon with her, with a company who promises that they will get you out of the contract for X amount of dollars. We went online for the BBB rating and the Yelp rating, and they were both kind of mixed reviews.
Yep.
Just hesitant to go with a program like this.
So here, I get this question all the time. Oh, I got a little bit of an echo here, Anne. I'm going to put you on hold and listen to the answer. You know, first of all, timeshares really, put down the beer goggles when you're on vacation. Really read and really understand that these things are forever, and these can bankrupt you, and they do all the time. It's very difficult to get out of these. You can ask the timeshare people to let you out. They generally don't let you out. Some of them do. You can sell it. Good luck with that, because people don't want them because of the problem of getting out of them. You can also rent it out and hopefully make some money on it, but that takes a lot of energy and diligence. Or you can walk away from it, let them sue you, and file bankruptcy. Those are all very difficult choices to make. So these companies that do it, I cannot vouch for them because some of them seem like they have good reputations, but I have had just as many calls from people who have used these companies and have been told, yes, you pay this money and we're going to do this for you, and it doesn't work out. So I can't recommend any one company on this. I really can't. I have not experienced a company where people say this works out and it's happened, it's worked, because there's really no legal way to do it. I wouldn't know how they would go about doing it. And I would recommend that maybe you hire an attorney for just a short period of time, and maybe you Google around, and actually, why don't you email me? I think there are some lawyers out there who kind of deal with timeshares. They're going to know who the better people are. So give me a quick email at WGN@AskKarenConti.com. And maybe I can find you a lawyer who can give you some advice to read the contract and say, is this going to work out for you, or is this just a waste of time? Is this more money down the pipe there? Let's go to I had a text from a person who said the judge ruled a parent had a right to keep the child from the grandparent. No, like I'm wrong. Okay, so I'm wrong. Now, I'm not wrong, because I have brought numerous grandparents' right cases in Illinois, and I've won them. And the right circumstances are not easy. You have to have a situation, like I said, where the parent is unavailable. And you have to be certain circumstances, and they have to be withholding the child in an unreasonable fashion. And the judge said that, so the texter says, the judge says the state law is the parent has the right not to have grandparent visitation. He said he didn't think it was right, but that was what the law said. You came to the Joliet for the case. I'm not sure what that means. But anyway, I am right. There are ways to see your grandchild in the right circumstances. It's not easy, but the cases can be won if the facts are correct. So I'm going to just talk briefly in the last few minutes that we have about this special prosecutor issue in the Jussie Smollett case. As you may remember, Smollett, they dropped the charges against him. He did community service and he paid a fine, and we thought the case was going away. And a judge, a former judge, Sheila O'Brien, who I know is a very smart lady, she was on the appellate court, and she on her own, for no good reason other than what she thought she was doing was right, which is a good reason. I didn't mean it wasn't a good reason. I mean, for no apparent reason, brought this petition to ask that a special prosecutor be appointed to investigate the dropping of the charges. What happened here? We all were kind of amazed that he was charged with 15 counts of disorderly conduct in making false police reports and lying to the police. And then all of a sudden, everything was dropped and he didn't plead guilty to anything. And I think everyone was kind of awestruck and wondered, was there favoritism here? Were there phone calls made? Was there something political that went on here? And we need to have some transparency. And Judge Tooman, who was the judge appointed to decide whether we're going to have a special process server, he's a very good judge. He's been on the bench for 40 years. And he said yes. He said he said in a 21-page opinion, and he was pretty critical of the state's attorney's office. He said he didn't rule on the issue of whether dropping the charges was inappropriate. He said that because the state's attorney, Kim Fox, said she was recusing herself. She said she was recusing herself. What it turned out to be, there were some phone calls made, and it appeared that she may have been influenced, or she didn't want people to think she was influenced. And she said, I'm recusing myself. But instead of allowing someone else to choose who was going to prosecute him and continue the prosecution, she gave it to her, a deputy, someone in her own office. And Judge Tooman said, you can't do that. Once you've decided that you have a conflict, or maybe you have a conflict or an appearance of impropriety, then you need to get it out of your office, because you're the elected official. You can't just decide someone else gets to make these determinations, especially in a case here that's high profile in nature. So the judge was pretty scathing and said, no, we're going to have a processor, a special prosecutor, and the case is now going to be assigned to somebody. We don't know who it's going to be. He suggested perhaps someone at the attorney general's office, or maybe another county's prosecutor. And we've seen special prosecutors. In the Laquan McDonald case, the Kane County prosecutor came in and tried the case. In the John Burge case, we had a special prosecutor. I don't know if you remember remember the Mayor Daley's nephew was in a bar fight and someone died. Dan Webb, the private lawyer from Winston & Strawn, fabulous lawyer, he did the investigation, and if necessary, he would have prosecuted the nephew if that was appropriate. It turned out that he didn't find that he did anything wrong. So this happens all the time, and it's going to happen. So now we're going to get to see what really happened behind the scenes as to why these charges were brought. One of the things that's really interesting is that the judge said, yeah, new charges could be brought against Jussie Smollett. And one of the things that I'm hearing on the street is, well, isn't that double jeopardy? He was already charged. He, you know, the charges were dropped. Now they're going to charge him again. That's double jeopardy. Well, double jeopardy, does not attach until the case is tried. Okay, so the case was never tried. In fact, there was no plea bargain. In fact, the decision was to withdraw all charges, which really means like the charges were never brought in the first place. So here you have charges withdrawn. He did his community service and is fine. But the judge is saying that perhaps under the right circumstances, we can have him charged again. Now, there are some rules that prosecutors are governed by. There's like a code of conduct that sort of applies to prosecutors that says, you know, unless there's extraneous circumstances, we're going to make the prosecutors honor their deals, which makes sense. If you make a deal with a prosecutor, you kind of think it's going to be upheld and that you're not going to be back in court because you honor the handshake that says, I'll do this, you do that. So there's going to have to be something very compelling, I think, to have Jussie Smollett prosecuted again. That's my opinion, but we will see. And at least I think in this regard, we're going to see what happened behind the scenes. We're going to make it transparent. And I think it's going to be a very good thing for us to know exactly what happened, because I think we all, in some way, shape, or form, were a little dismayed at how the whole thing went down.